Welcome to the Agile Revolution. We're at day one, Agile 2015, and I am sounding way perkier than I really am. It's Renee, and with me is...
Oh, hello, I'm Craig, and we're in Washington.
Washington?
DC.
DC.
DC, the big kahuna, the nation's capital of the other nation.
I visited the big kahuna. It's the monument, isn't it?
No, the White House.
No, well, I was more thinking about what the monument looks like, but anyway...
Okay. You're talking about the Washington Monument, aren't you? And the rest of the listeners can figure out on their own. We're at Agile 2015. It's the big conference of the year, day one, and kicked off the day with Luke Homan. What do you think, Renee?
So I was very excited to see Luke on the program, especially as there's very few keynotes.
And innovation games has been... We've talked about this before.
I was hoping he would do a game. There was no game, but I was hoping that if he didn't do a game... that he would do his whole San Jose, this is how I'm revolutionising the world, and he did, and it was awesome.
So, yeah, I'd seen a variant of this talk, I guess, when it was very fresh, and to me, I think the benefit I got from it was seeing now how it's moved on. I was sort of quite familiar with the San Jose thing. I guess for those who don't know, Luke created a game, we created a bunch of games, but he created a company a bunch of years ago called Innovation Games, which a lot of the games that I think we know and love now originally came from and he wrote a book on it called Innovation Games as well. So things like retro sailboats or speedboats, buy a feature type games. So things that either you may have played or have been slightly modified for the purpose. So he's been around in the community for a long time. But one of the things that he did a few years ago, talking on a plane to someone from San Jose government, was found a way to help them with their deficit problem in that city.
Their $100 million deficit.
You need to go into a bit of the history about that. I think some of the things about the pennies and stuff was quite interesting when I saw the extended version of this talk. The way they used to do town planning was everyone would get a roll of pennies and they'd have to put it into a bucket, essentially. It was just a voting scheme, like putting things in the bucket. And I remember the quote he had in the last talk I saw a few years ago, which he said, with the penny system, it was so useless that you actually would have been better off keeping the pennies rather than in the bucket. But what they did was they essentially... what I liked with this was they had... The difference is that when we talk about buying features, they had no money to buy it with because they're already $1 million in deficit. So if they wanted to do anything with the city, they had to stop something that they were already funding in order to pay for something new. So they had green sheets, which were the features that you could buy, and red sheets, which are the things you had to stop. And the things you had to stop were things like a firefighting truck can have four firemen on instead of five. Obviously... dropped the comment about when they actually did the roll-up, they were surprised for things like pavement maintenance got more funding than library funding.
Did you notice, though, that pavement maintenance got more funding 2 years in a row?
Well, people like driving
on
roads.
What's wrong with the pavements here?
Well, you notice when the pavement isn't maintained, I think, is more the problem. You haven't done a lot of driving on US roads, Renee.
I thought a pavement was a footpath. It's not.
Pavement's the road.
Oh, well, so. Now I get it more now. Mm. Okay, right. Don't we call a pavement a football? Anyway.
Sure.
Fine.
Filling potholes.
Right. So the interesting thing for me is I wondered whether that the set of people who were prioritising were really truly representative of the community's needs. They were neighbourhood leaders, youth leaders, I think, as well.
Mm-hmm.
But is it the voice of the whole? And I think, you know, I was really pleased to see that over time, as he's continued to evolve it, he's continued to expand the audience out and get more and more voices heard.
Well, it's scaled, right?
Yeah. So I'm glad that it went that way, and I'm really just curious if it would have matched what the majority would have wanted.
But I wonder if it's the other way around. With the governments we're used to, a voice is maybe they do a forum once every 4 years. So I think the difference here is they actually had a voice. You can apply to be a community leader, or you can even apply, I think, to come along to these funding meetings. So, it's like a town hall type meeting. So I think that's a big difference to some other parts of the world where citizens actually get involved. I think down in our part of the world, Renee, we're usually a bit apathetic and it's someone else's job, but... I think you find in some of these communities here, particularly, as people are a lot more involved in their community, partly because they probably have to be.
So I was really glad to see that it evolved over time to be online, because I think, you know, that obviously scales way more.
And he had an interesting thing about that, right, is that by bringing it online, what they actually found was the engagement
increased.
Yeah, it didn't sort of lose anything. People were actually really happy that they didn't have all these other voices and they didn't feel conflicted and they weren't being biased. They could go through it in their own pace, and that's not what we typically see in distributed agile.
Yeah, because we always want to have teams who can collaborate, who can actually pick up on each other's body language so that we can adjust how we work together. But I think maybe it's because they weren't working together long term. Maybe it was because it was a short term goal that was why it was valuable.
Because they're not really a team, are they?
They're
a spin up team.
No, in fact, they don't actually have to interact other than prioritize, which is intriguing. So it's more intriguing for the situations where you have multiple product owners all feeding into a single team, like in a BAU sort of maintenance environment.
Mm.
That is where it gets a bit more intriguing from an applicability perspective.
But I guess where he was going to in this talk, and he then started talking about applying the same logic to the water shortage problem in California and applying that to business problems. And I think that's probably where the learning is a little bit, is this probably wasn't so much team-based activity at this point, but organisational-wide. So he was making the difference between making decisions in an organisation where, again, it's not a team with a product owner. It's where we actually have to make decisions. And in this case, applying it to an even bigger problem, which is a community issue, which in that case is actually pretty catastrophic in no water in California. I liked his... he kind of went off to base a little bit because he was talking about technical debt, but I really liked... He dropped in this little quote about something called Lundy's Law, which I think I've heard before, but it's nice to give it a little name now, is that any group of programmers given enough time will justify a total rewrite of the system.
And I've seen that as well.
So have I. So I think that one holds true from what I can see. And he left us with, a challenge at the end, which is games can be serious, and what two games can you play in the next 12 months that'll change the world? So I think the challenge is, what can you do, go back with your team to try and solve problems, and what can you do at a wider level to change the community?
I think that was more the takeaway for me, is that community element. I mean, for a while now, I've wanted to revolutionise politics inside of Australia, and it's still itching away at me, and that talk sort of continued to scratch away my soul, going, you really should get onto that, and sort of...
Well, I think we've spoken about this before, and we spoke about this after I saw this talk a number of years ago. It's been a few years since you've been going on about that, and I think the problem I had was that interaction, having seen now that the online thing works.
Yeah, and I had always envisaged that was the only way that it was ever going to work, and he's doing it once a year, and I always envisaged it would actually be way more frequent than that as well.
So we'll be on to something. What else have you seen at the conference? What were the highlights for day one for you? What else did you want to
do? So I went to a session with Paul Goddard on oh my god,
jet lag is kicking in.
Starts with I. Improvisation games.
I knew what it was. I just wanted to see how long it was going to take you to spit it out.
And it was a whole pile of improv games, which I think we ended up doing 4 or 5. I can't quite remember the number.
So we're talking improv, and I think the thing I normally associate with is the people, you think of the show, Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the kind of thing we're talking about here, right?
Well, yes and no. So he distinguishes it, because improv traditionally, whilst there is a segment or a field that is related to comedy, improv isn't just comedy. It is drama, and it is theatre, and it is acting. So just because it's improv doesn't actually mean it has to be funny. So you can still do improv and take learnings out of it, and don't have to feel that it has to be funny.
Okay. So you could quote your business requirements in Shakespeare, for example.
No, that's not quite how the games work. So one of the games that I participated in up at the front was a line of about 8 people, and one person starts by going in front of the line and they say, I'm a monkey, for example, and then another person comes in and they say, I'm a banana tree, and then another person comes in and says, I'm a
Bananarama.
An animal hunter or something like that. So you've got a story there, a narrative. And then what happens is the first person then chooses one person to leave, and then the first person and whoever was chosen then leave. And so that person, let's say it was the animal hunter, then goes, I'm an animal hunter. And then another person enters and they start the second element of that story. So it's all these varying little stories that are sort of interconnected.
So the same characters remain, but people switch in and out of the characters?
So of the one person that remains, they remain the same character. Mm-hmm. But then you switch in and out new stories.
Okay. But new characters or different characters?
There'll be different characters, okay. Yeah.
So I could come in and say, I'm a banana salesman.
Yeah. Or in that case, if you had an animal hunter, you'd probably have a lion, for example, or an elephant, or, I don't know,
So they're related to the person who stays behind.
Well, not necessarily. So that wasn't a condition that was put on. It's just naturally through the art of storytelling, we sort of wanted it to have connectiveness. And that was the point of the exercise.
So I could have walked in and said, I'm an agile coach.
You could have. That would have been funny. So in the example that I was in, someone was in the ocean drowning. I think someone was a lifeguard, and I ran in and I became Pamela Anderson.
Oh dear God. Moving right along.
So it was really good. So there were games around safety, games around spontaneity, selflessness, sharing, connectivity.
So what's the wrap up? How do you use what you learned in there out in the real world? Is it just some more things in your toolkit?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But I think there's some really good team starters as well. So if you've got brand new teams, run the safety game. That'd be really good.
Awesome. Is that stuff written up anywhere? Is it available?
Yes. He's got a book and it's come out just in the last month. Thank you for reminding me.
Awesome.
Called Improv Agile Games, something like that.
Okay.
Orange cover.
Yeah, it's a lean pub, I think, isn't it? From memory, maybe?
I'm not quite sure. So
about the same time, I went and I did some UXing. I decided to go and see something that maybe I should know more about, which was learning like a scientist. I really want to see how the UX area is thinking about experimentation. And I've heard a bit about Will before, so I was kind of keen to go see him. There was a lot of the same stuff in there, a lot of stuff about experiments. And what I really liked was, even from that level, the message really clearly in that session was, you got to start with a problem. So many people try to turn vision statements and things into solutions. And even
problem or opportunity?
Yeah.
But, okay, right.
You got to get away from the solution. And he had a bunch of hypothesis templates is what I'm looking for. Hypothesis templates, and he was relaying a story about in so many organisations he goes into, and people just turn those hypothesis templates straight into solutions. Which when you're beginning, all you really want to do is just start, collating things to experiment on. And he had this nice little model about how you kind of start with a strategy, generate lots of options. So you go wide, throw a whole bunch of options out there, and then you have to converge them to a set of...
It's well known.
Yeah. And things that you move on for, and then diverge out to a bunch of solutions and then back again.
Yeah.
And what I was trying to think of is, I think that's something, even when we're in early stage planning, that I don't think we do... We often think about experimentation being for small things, not even for large projects or... Because quite often what we don't do is think about a lot of different options. We're having a lot of different experiments that we can even validate before we start to go to those. We typically just have an idea, we throw out a few options, and then we go with it. So I think that was kind of what had me thinking a little bit, to learn from that a little more.
Did they refer to it as design thinking, or...?
He mentioned design thinking all the way, but that's only really one part of the
chain. It is, yeah. It's one of like 10 or 12 elements in it, yeah.
Yeah. He had a few canvases and things. He mentioned Carl Sagan and his BS checking type hypothesis. So there's a bunch of little tidbits, I think, in that talk, which were good. So nothing earth-shatteringly new, but it was just nice to hear it from the UX perspective.
So I'm blinking because I'm still very tired and I can't actually remember the names or the name of the sessions that I went to in the afternoon. So one was on scaling.
So you went to a scaling session. And there's been a few scaling sessions at the conference. So.
And another one was on transformation in a very large organisation. And it was So both of them wasn't anything that I terribly knew. The scaling one sort of felt like an ask to me, which was another scaling solution.
Yeah. There seems to be a lot of those wandering around the place, isn't there? Everyone's got an opinion on scaling.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, it was just scaling. And here I'm finding everyone's kind of saying, no, that sucks, and then coming up with another one. So now we've got, instead of three big ones that aren't so good, now we've got about 100 ones that still aren't so good.
Yeah, it was interesting. There was a topic in Lean Coffee around it this morning, if you were here very, very early, about...
No wonder you're yawning.
Yeah, because it was up at 4 a.m. But, you know, do we need more frameworks? And my response to it is, whilst we still have problems, which we do, we still have problems. Of course we need more solutions. And it's going to be likely that there's going to be more frameworks to solve the solutions. Now, for me, the biggest thing that I'm looking at the piece of paper in front of me, which is another example of it, the biggest deal is there's too many certifications.
Yeah, this is another certification which is taking your coaching skills to the next level with a coaching health radar. And
which is by the Agile Coach Institute, which is normally pretty good, right?
And then, well, I don't know, I think now that's a sponsoring. Oh, that's a sponsoring thing.
Oh, right.
That's the sponsor of the health of the stage.
There you go.
And then another thing here about Lockheed Martin and their EVM for Agile development. So, we're just about to head back to the sponsor pavilion again, but yeah, every man and his dog is giving away a certification or a scaling framework.
It's just,
or a tool.
There's just too many of them. It's ridiculous. It's already too complicated, and I do agree that there's a real risk by adding more and more frameworks in it. It's just, I already think it's at the point where it's way overwhelming.
So my afternoon was, I went to a session on probabilistic forecasting, which is a lot of Monte Carlo simulations and the like. And I think the one takeaway I got from that is putting some of those options into a formula and running some simulations is actually well worth your time, particularly when you're trying to perhaps convince someone that you shouldn't go for the least cost option. So nothing necessarily new in there, but
there was risk in there as well.
Yeah, a little bit of risk. But yeah, I mean, what you're saying is that people always go for, are people going to go for the least risky thing, or are they going to go for the thing that costs more money? And there's a break point where either option holds true.
Yep.
He did a simulation on one which was, option one, 25% lose $1 million, make $1 million, or make
$8 million.
$3 million. And then the second one was, then the second one had an $8 million sort of line in it. And most people will take the no-risk option. You know, it's not lose $1 million, but just gain $1 million. But actually, that only holds true if you're doing one to two projects at a time. And then once you get past that, it actually taking a bet on lots of smaller experiments actually pays off to take the risk.
So we should split our superannuation into lots of little risky things?
Which is why you think about it in superannuation. You do put it into funds where they do spread you can spread your portfolio.
There you go.
So, yes, you're much better putting in that than shoving in the safe one. You know.
Finally, a practical tip on the Agile Revolution.
There you go. And then I went to an awesome session, which is a nice end of the day on conflict resolution, which you've done a similar one at your Agile Games conference a few months ago.
Yeah, I saw Ellen do it a couple of months ago.
Yeah, Ellen Grove. So lots of really good games and ways to think about conflict. And what I really liked about that particular talk is, I mean, lots of conflict talks before, but it's about you as a coach and how you deal with it. What I liked this was things you can actually play with your team to get them talking about conflict.
Exactly.
So lots of little games that won't do any justice talking about them on the air, but I think the key thing out of there is you have to bring it to it, even if you've got a new team. How do they feel about conflict, and then how do you deal with it when it moves past? There are lots of fun ways of dealing with it. But I guess the last thing, this is your first Agile conference, Renee. I'm a bit of a veteran. This isn't quite the massive hotels that I've had in the past, although the conference center is still pretty big.
Okay, it feels pretty massive,
But yeah, what's your 2,200 Agiles crammed in one space? Any thoughts?
You know, it's interesting. I thought it would feel more, like it is vast, don't get me wrong, and it's lots of rooms, lots of people. But I thought it'd be hard to find people that I know. And it's not.
No, you've ran to me at least 7 times and I've rolled your eyes every time I've seen you.
Yeah.
Oh, man, him again?
But, so it's still, it feels big, but it still feels intimate. Mm. And that's really good. So some of the things that were really surprising, or that I actually really appreciated, and not necessarily 100% of the time, was just the ability at lunch times and break times, for example, just to be forced to sit with someone else and to communicate and to share stories over lunch. Mm. I like that.
And even in the sessions, where you just sit down and just by the art of it, you have to introduce yourself, and well, you don't have to, but you know, you introduce yourself and then meet somebody new. And most of the friends I've sort of met at this conference have always been in that through that kind of thing. So yeah, it's a good thing. And I do like the way they do the lunches here, where it's kind of laid out to kind of.
I was unfortunate that no one on either side of me talked to me at lunch. They were talking to each other. I'm going, oh dear.
Sometimes you didn't get to talk to anybody, so it looked like a good idea, just you didn't get to meet anybody.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was very busy and there was no seats, and anyway.
And I think the open space works here well. It's something we haven't seen necessarily on our side of the world, but there's an open space. We're just looking at it down the corridor here, and there's just stuff going on all day there, which is awesome. And I think part of that is, I think, there's some real community leaders who are pushing sort of people through that, but secondly, I think because some of the popular sessions get sold out very quickly, it almost forces people sometimes to come out and just sit in the open space. So when I was actually walk past, there was lots of activity going on in that open space session, particularly during the day. So, and last of all, at least, I guess we're about to head back down there, the sponsor booths.
The drinkies.
But in that sponsorship pavilion, there's lots of craziness going down there too, right? There's lots of vendors selling their wares.
A lot of... It saddens me, a lot of tools.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And tools for your tools.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does this plug in for Jira and that plug in for HP?
Though I must admit, as we're busy writing a visual management book at the moment, I thought, you know, maybe next year we should actually have a booth and all it has in it is really cool post-it notes and stickers and pens and whatever else. That would be cool.
I mean, there is a bookstore. Do you have a look at the bookstore over there? I mean,
I have.
I think that's really cool, but even though the books do sell out, most of the authors go and buy them, which is actually more than funny. I've seen at least twice, on two occasions, authors of books decided, I should give some of those away in my talk, and they go and buy 20 books and walk away with them. So,
wow. Okay.
I've seen that twice, the author carrying 20 of their books, and I went, this is sad, they're just buying them for their mum, so they look like they're sold out. But I think it's good just sort of people, because it's like a big table of just agile books.
Yeah.
And so it's
yeah.
nice for people to come and glance across the top of them.
They're not all just agile books too. There's quite a bit of variety in there.
So I should rephrase, books that are pertinent to the agile community. So there's things from leadership and all sorts of different books in there. But,
yep.
But it's not like going to a normal bookstore.
No, not at all.
Where you can only find one book, or searching on Amazon, which will sometimes be a bit clunky, or you know what it wants to serve you. So. Anyway, that's our day one. We'll try and get back. Yeah. We'd like to do it every day, but we'll try and get back at least one time before the end of the conference, if not more. So we'll go and have some drinks now and network some people. But until then, Renee,
Viva la Revolution.